Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle and I will start this week by saying you are all incredibly lucky that last week's Betball Accumulator, we didn't actually find time to put it together because it went awfully wrong, and because we will not hide from our mistakes, let me remind you of what we thought would happen in the Premier League last weekend. We said Norwich Man City was over 5.5 goals, and although we were close to that, it was because of Mo's 6-2 Man City prediction, one of the main reasons why we put that. I also suggested that Aguero might score in both halves. You could again argue that he should have, but he didn't. We had a Squawker Talker special Wolves 2, Chelsea 2. Got the Wolves goals correct, but Chelsea decided to score 5. And Spurs versus Crystal Palace, a prediction, again, I will take the blame for it. I said that Crystal Palace might sneak another away win against a Big Six side, only for them to lose 4-0. So not a very successful week, but luckily none of you could have followed it that week, but we will be trying to do it for this week's prediction, so look out for that. And anyway, join BetBall and follow other people that probably have better predictions. It's a community after all, so you can follow anyone and everyone, not just Squawker Football. But this week is also different because we have some actual football to review rather than just previewing completely. The Champions League has returned, and joining me to talk about what exactly happened is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome.
Oh, this is going to be good.
And also chief editor at Squawker,
yes,
Will Hall.
It's really me.
It's really him. And finally, rich content editor, Sam Long.
How's it going?
It's going really well because, as I said, the Champions League is back. And of course, as always, every week, there's only one place to start. And this is mainly because Just Kuda asked us, what exactly went wrong with Real Madrid? They had 0 shots on target for the first time in a Champions League match since records began, losing 3-0 to PSG. The first time they've lost an opening fixture of a Champions League campaign since 2006. So Mr. Inevitable, Zinedine Zidane, who never loses the Champions League, has not started brilliant.
No, he has not. Of course, though, with Zinedine Zidane, it's almost irrelevant what he does in the group stages. Let's see what happens on knockout rounds to begin. But Real Madrid were terrible. They were just awful. It was, with the exception of Gareth Bale in the first half, and Rafael Varane for everything up to the leading up to the third goal, just terrible. Every single player was just useless. Eden Hazard, I literally repeatedly forgot he was even playing the game. Like, and I've never ever forgotten Eden Hazard's playing a game, because you can't, because he gets on the ball and he does his dribbles, even if he's not actually on his end product. He's always dribbling well. Nothing. Just, if he touched the ball, which he barely did, he didn't do anything with it. Bale already tried first half, had a goal ruled out, which is unfortunate, but he wouldn't have scored if he hadn't handballed it.
Should say as well, so the naught shots on target is obviously legal shots, because yes, they had two goals disallowed.
Benzema's goal was, I thought that was more unfortunate than Bale's, because that was an astounding finish, which was ruled out correctly again for Lucas Vazquez basically throwing him a screen while being offside. But yeah, that was also, so they had two shots on target that were ruled out for offside, and you think, what would Real Madrid have done if VAR been around when they were making their big three in the three wins in a row?
He had to be the one to say who had that on their bingo card.
Rafael Varane was very good. I thought he was holding their defense at bay, but Eden Militao, it's his first, he didn't really look comfortable at all. I mean, he's still adapting. This is not a summary judgment on Emilio Tau. He's still a very good player. We saw that for Porto last season. But he looked very much nervous. Didn't close Di Maria down at all for either of Di Maria's goals. Excellent finishes, by the way, from Di Maria. Two really, really well-taken goals. The players you should be concerned about, because obviously, look, no one played well, but there are two players who I think more than anyone else really need to be looked at with concern, because Hazard, yeah, he was rubbish, but
he's also his first start.
He's two games into his Real Madrid career. We know he's a great player. Yeah. Relax. It's funny to laugh at him, but he'll be brilliant in a month and then whatever. But the two players I think is very right to be concerned about is Courtois, who is just yet again beaten no clean sheet since early February for him.
Yeah.
Beaten his near post twice.
Yeah, the near post, Di Maria, his shot. You've got to be a superhuman to react to that. Yeah. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
No, not necessarily.
I think the biggest thing for Courtois is no clean sheets since February. Keylor Navas goes to PSG, two games, two clean sheets. And in that time, and Courtois this season, five games, nine goals conceded.
There was a picture of them all gathering, and it looks like Courtois is winking at him. I don't think he is. I think he's looking somewhere else.
Navas winking at Courtois.
It looks like Navas is winking at Courtois, but I don't think he is. I think he's winking at probably one of his ex-teammates that he probably left on very good terms with.
Yeah, I think Navas even said that after the game. So it was very weird seeing the Real Madrid players in the tunnel.
And you could tell, I mean, he did make a save, and you could tell, I do think if they'd gotten on shots on target, I don't think he would have been at his best. I think he was sort of a bit...
Like caught up.
Yeah, because I mean, it has to be difficult. He's a very, you know, emotional man, Courtois. And I mean, it's probably a big occasion. He didn't really want to leave Real Madrid, remember?
Navas, sorry.
You keep swapping. Get your goalkeepers right.
I need to remember, one of them is good, one of them is rubbish.
Oh, there you go.
Rubbish. Another player was Toni Kroos. Toni Kroos was just objectively horrendous. You know, but he's always been, he got dribbled past, like, what, eight times? Something like
Four times.
Well, okay.
But look.
Since the start of 2018-19, right? He's played 696 passes, which is the eighth most. So he's dropped off in his passing. Because look, since 16-17, sorry, he's played 2,310 passes in the Champions League. That's first, and 93.71% success rate. That's huge. He doesn't give the ball away, but he's been dribbled past 52 times, which is joint third with Casemiro. So people have always been able to walk past him, right? But he compensated for that by being an amazing pass for the ball. So, you know, okay, fine, he was defensively useless, but he helped Madrid dominate the ball, played great passes, all that stuff.
Just remember, Real Madrid have played the most games in that period.
And he has the most, chances created in the last decade. So it's not, like I said, he's had weaknesses, but he's always made up for them, always balanced out for them. In the last, since 18-19, so since Zidane left the first time, his passing has dropped off. 696 passes he's made. That's eighth, right? And he's still getting dribbled past. Like 21 times he's been dribbled past. So he's still getting bamboozled by opponents. And he's no longer passing the ball effectively. If you watched him yesterday, it's unrecognisable from Toni Kroos of 2 years ago. He could barely pull a pass, let alone a penetrative pass. Every time he tried to play something forward through the lines, PSG just pick it off easily. Like, he got outplayed by Marquinhos. Marquinhos is a defender.
Marquinhos was it not him that completely... Man marked Paul Pogba out of the game, though.
Yeah, but man marking someone is different.
No, like, what I'm saying is Toni Kroos not being able to deal with Marquinhos in midfield is something that other great midfielders have also found out in the Champions League that is more difficult to do than one.
He also got bamboozled by Idrissa Gueye more than one occasion, and I mean, Verratti is very good, so that's not really a bad.
I think the thing with Toni Kroos, and again, I'm more sort of trying to contest certain points. He does look like he's struggling, and Real Madrid's main concern, and as Will said, and he knows what's coming now, I've been mentioning all week that on their squad list for that PSG game, they had three goalkeepers and three midfielders. So whether Toni Kroos is playing badly or not, at the moment he has to play.
Yeah.
And that's probably not a good thing. You would imagine that he still gets into Zidane's side, but even if Zidane really wanted to change Toni Kroos, he can't at the moment because they sold Llorente, they loaned Dani Ceballos, and then everyone else is injured, including Modric himself. But moving away from Real Madrid's badness, it would be sort of unfair not to highlight that PSG played pretty well. And they did it without Neymar, Mbappe or Cavani up front. Angel Di Maria becoming the second former Real Madrid player to score a Champions League brace against Real Madrid after Klaas Jan Huntelaar. And leading the line, he seemed to flourish in that role of being the main man. But a Champions League campaign also started with a 3-0 win against one of the European giants. 2 years ago, PSG actually beat Bayern Munich 3-0, only to later lose the return leg, or not return leg, but in the group stage, the reverse fixture, 3-1. So should we be getting excited again about PSG have finally complete their quest to win the Champions League? Or is it just because Real Madrid are really bad and we might just see what happened in 2017-18 again?
Real Madrid were very bad. The difference between the last night's win and the Bayern Munich win that you referred to, I think, was that in that game, that was an inspired Neymar performance. And then what cost PSG later on in the campaign was the absence of Neymar. Like, they've been knocked out by marginal, the odd goal, and I think Neymar would have made the difference, and they probably would have progressed had he not suffered those metatarsal injuries. But last night's game, what was most striking about it for me is that for two teams heavily associated with individualistic Galacticos approaches to squad building, the game was decided by team players, two in particular that I'll talk about. I think their second best performer, or at least one of the best performers who wasn't the star headline guy that Angel Di Maria was Idrissa Gueye. He used his post-match interview to drive home the message that we played as a team today. And if you look back on previous results PSG have recorded in the group stages, there was one that was a 2-2 draw with Napoli last season, which Thomas Tuchel was quite... One of the points he stressed was that they were playing like a collective of individuals rather than a team. But going back to Idrissa Gueye, who was obviously a team player because he's one that's famous for winning the ball back and then laying it off to players with more... known for having a more expansive passing range. I spoke to an Everton fan who suggested that selling him to PSG might not be the worst thing ever because of his limited passing range. But last night, he was constantly progressing play against Madrid. I know he completed more passes ending in the final third than anyone on the pitch, with 25. He got the assist, which was a remarkable finish from outside the box. But he was in that final third, making contributions. It's one of the most complete performances you'll ever see in a Champions League game. Rio Ferdinand, as many will have seen, said that Idrissa Gueye looked like a player who'd been playing at that level for years, when in fact it's his Champions League debut. I'm fairly confident in saying, unless he's.
I think I saw someone say that it was 7 years since his last Champions League.
Who would have thought?
So it's his
same difference.
It's practically a debut.
Who would have thought that Eden Hazard would be the less impressive of the Lille alumni on the pitch last night?
Exactly. I mean, this is a game that was Hazard's first start, and there's no bigger game. There's no tougher game that Real Madrid have on their schedule in the Champions League, at least so far, that he could have made his full debut in. So this game was probably meant to be about Eden Hazard arriving, when in fact it was about Idrissa Gueye, summer signing, bit of a low-key one, and Angel Di Maria, who's one of the best modern examples of a player who blends flair and work rate. He's a guy who has a man-of-the-match award from a Champions League final, 2014, yet is constantly overshadowed wherever he goes. Most recently by a player who doesn't even want to be in the team he plays for. Tuchel said he tried everything in his power to leave Paris. And to wrap up this section on Di Maria, or perhaps not, because I'm sure other people have lots to say about him. A Carlo Ancelotti quote who says Di Maria is a team player more than anything else. He's not a selfish player at all. I think last night was meant to be about Hazard, Gareth Bale coming back into the fold, how PSG would fare in the Champions League without Neymar, but the story was actually two very talented and very functional players, Idrissa Gueye and Angel Di Maria.
Yeah, and Di Maria as well. I think almost that Cavani that we've spoken about. Cavani, I know Cavani is in that PSG front three that was missing. Di Maria has that about him that it's like, when you look back on his career, despite the sort of not the great displays for Argentina or the spell in Man United that ended a bit sour, you look back and realise, hold on, you're one of the greatest players of this era, really.
Oh, he's had some amazing...
I was surprised when you put him in your... I think you put him in your set... In the Champions League team of the decade piece, we decided, there's too many good players to do one. So we do like a first tier, second tier, third tier, a bit like you said in the NBA.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I was surprised to see him, I think, in your second
tier. He's in the third tier.
I was surprised to see him basically in it at all. Mm. And I think that kind of proves the point I was making, that he's overshadowed when I'm under 18.
And then
myself.
When you're actually looking at it, you're like, maybe you should be in the second one.
I mean, he's a sensational player. And even you look at the brief period of his life in England where he wasn't like depressed and wanting to leave, and he was ridiculous.
I was going to say, he actually started at Man United really well, and then there was just...
Ridiculous chip
against Leicester.
He just got unhappy, basically. He wasn't happy living in the country. I think that ultimately people have to acknowledge, people didn't acknowledge it back then, but you would acknowledge it now. real world issues, real life mental health issues, they play a part. You know, if you're not happy in your real life, it's hard to be productive on the pitch. And that's what happened to Di Maria in England. And I thought it was so weird last year when United fans were booing him at Old Trafford. Like, why? He didn't play well. It wasn't his fault.
I think the manner in which he left, he did. I think he went on strike or something like
that. I think that whole... I remember that when that happened last year, there were a lot of... I put a certain caption on a picture of it, and then a lot of Man United fans were keen to stress the real story behind it. So I don't even really want to dive into
basically,
Man United
very,
performance.
He's a very, very good player.
Talking about him being overshadowed, though, he even got overshadowed at the World Cup when he scored that absolute banger against France, but then Pavard scored his goal in the tournament in the same game, and no one remembers it.
I mean, it's funny, you mentioned underperforming for Argentina. It's actually, it's Di Maria's failure to stay fit that's often cost Argentina, really, because, I mean, when he and Messi were fit together all the way through a tournament, they won the Olympics in 2008. And then in the World Cup, they looked like they were progressing quite nicely. Then he got injured against Belgium, and right away Argentina fell off a cliff because without him as the release for Messi's passes, they struggled.
Even in that game against Nigeria, I remember clearly thinking Di Maria has been rubbish in this game, and then he scored that one goal. So it's the two and the throw of it. But at club level and in Champions League and in these games,
I think
Di Maria has been probably one of the more consistent players.
Zidane would love to have him in his team. Zidane would, because when you look at the way Zidane plays Lucas Vazquez, who is a player of extremely limited technique but always works 200, gives 200%, holds his position, does exactly what Zidane asks. Zidane would adore Di Maria.
But Di Maria played in midfield. I think he's got these players like Isco, James Rodriguez, who are sort of, you know, as we always say, the dying breed of number 10s that necessarily don't want to do the work or whatever.
Yeah.
Di Maria played as a midfielder in a 4-3-3 before, and they won the Champions League doing it. So
Zidane was assistant then.
Exactly. So he's one of those players that, again, you forget. He obviously played... Their midfield was Verratti, Gay, Marquinhos. Yeah, yeah. So it was that more solid midfield, and he got to play forward. But perhaps when Neymar and Mbappe, Cavani come back, and against sides where they don't want to be as resolute, despite how good the performance was by Verratti and Gay, Di Maria just slots back in there, and you play Di Maria, Gay, and Verratti then at the base, and then it's a pretty nice midfield as well. Marquinhos slots back into centre mid.
There's a lot of options for PSG now that they've kept Neymar. I mean, you can see what they were thinking of getting rid of Neymar, because then you just play Di Maria permanently in the front three with Mbappe and with Cavani. But even with Neymar, like you say, against weaker sides, you don't have to, you know, it's just against big teams where they're going to have a problem, how to figure out how to incorporate everybody without losing the solidity. I thought Icardi was good last night as well. Shout out to Mauro Icardi. I think he held the ball up well. He looked, looked like he could handle himself, which is something obviously people, no one really doubted his quality, but everyone sort of forgot about it because of the controversies.
Two touches, one goal.
As long as Neymar's there, he'll be flying under the radar.
that is true, yes.
So moving on from PSG's midfield domination of Real Madrid, Mo alluded to the fact that without VAR, perhaps Zinedine Zidane wouldn't have any of his Champions League titles. Well, without Lionel Messi, Mo, Barcelona look like they're not going to win any themselves anytime soon. They got a point against Borussia Dortmund, mainly because of Neuer's understudy in the Barcelona goal, saving the penalty, which actually should have been retaken because of VAR, because he was off his line.
Yes.
But a really good performance from Ter Stegen. Marco Reus missing five big chances in that game, and no one else after the first match day had missed more than one. So, good goalkeeping performance as the basis for Barcelona getting a point, which is not really what they're going to be aiming for in the Champions League this season.
No, but at the same time, that was the hardest game of the group stage away to Dortmund, and they've come through it without a loss. I mean, they were lucky because Reus, for some reason, forgot his shooting boots and Ter Stegen had a worldie. But it was interesting because if you look, you compare Barcelona to Real Madrid, you could argue that, there's a similarity of weakness there and that they were susceptible. But you look at Barcelona and actually, for once, they're actually trending in a positive direction because... they got lucky because their fullbacks were terrible, but their fullback problem emerged because Jordi Alba got injured, and for some reason Valverde hadn't put Junior Firpo on the bench, so he had to put Semedo left back and Roberto right back. Now Semedo's a game defender, he played really well, but ultimately he's not a left back, and that not only killed Barcelona's defensive stability, it killed them offensively because they rely so much on Jordi Alba's overlaps to create width on the left that it completely shattered the entire system. So that's why Dortmund dominated most of the second half, because Barca had no outball without Alba. But you look at the midfield. The midfield is where really you get hope, because for the first time in I can't remember how long, Barca have a midfield that makes you go, oh, okay, that's serious business. Because you got Busquets, Arthur, and for the longest time, if you mark Busquets, Barca, the midfield was useless. You could just mark him, and then that was it. And that's what a lot of teams did in the Champions League, to knock them out, right? But Dortmund marked Busquets yesterday. He only had 38 passes all game. They really did a good job of clamping down on him. Arthur and Frenkie then stepped up and dominated the game in his absence. Arthur had 83 passes, 106 touches. Arthur and Frenkie both gained possession 9 times each. Frenkie had 57 passes in the Dortmund half. Like, they really, really dominated the ball. Frenkie in the last 10 minutes just went completely off the scale when he started pressing and tackling and winning everything and keeping Barca on the front foot. So that midfield gave Barcelona a lot of platform to, you'd think, create chances. But we spoke about Real Madrid only having no shots on target. Barca only had one. And the reason for that, and this is the problem Barcelona will have all season, which I alluded to in a piece of mine, is Luis Suarez is cooked. He's completely done. He's like overcooked chicken. He's done. Throw him out. Get rid of him. Or undercooked chicken. He's just rubbish, basically.
What's worse, under or overcooked?
Yeah.
He's just not good. He's not edible.
Undercooked chicken, you could just cook for a little bit longer.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Because you can't rescue chicken once it's gone.
He is a burnt piece of chicken.
There you go.
He's overcooked. He's done. Throw him out. He's useless.
To give context to that, Luis Suarez has not scored an away Champions League goal yes. since September 2015.
And he's only scored 2 goals in the last 2 editions of the Champions League.
I was stunned because I knew the away streak, and then yeah. I was like, oh, wonder. And I was like, wait, you've only scored 1 in each of the last 2 yeah. campaigns.
He's washed. He's a player.
So Toni Kroos and Luis Suarez, two players probably in these sides that need to be starting.
I mean, Kroos, I still think actually could have a lot to offer if you move into a club where he does no running whatsoever and he's just allowed to pass. Like if you put him in, like remember how Milan used to treat Pirlo, or Juventus treated Pirlo, where they put two absolute runners next to him and just said, you just pass the ball, and then he was brilliant. I think if you put Toni Kroos in that same situation, Kroos would be great again because I think Kroos's problem is just that he can't run, can't defend. Yeah. Suarez's problem is much more. I mean, he's 32, so it's obviously going to happen. But he's a big body striker who plays on the limits of physicality. He can't slow down. Like Cristiano Ronaldo famously has pared his game down to only the essentials and managed to extend his career, right? Suarez can't do that because everything is essential for him. He has to play 100%. So he's just exhausted. His lungs give out after 20 minutes, if even he lasts that long. Against Dortmund, he was their second best defender after Mats Hummels, who, by the way, oh my god,
yeah,
amazing.
His game by numbers was obscene.
Yeah, he was incredible.
Putting that out and looking through. Well, this is the thing, is again to lean on sort of what we saw from Borussia Dortmund. Obviously, yeah. Jadon Sancho winning the penalty, that's going to be a feature of their season.
Yeah.
Paco Alcacer, the first game he didn't score in, obviously, was against Barcelona, which was a narrative would have been brilliant if Suarez had not scored in 19 Champions League games and Alcacer was scoring the other end. But alas, that didn't happen. It ended up being 0-0. And as you said, Barcelona, obviously, I don't think they necessarily looked great. Dortmund had plenty of chances to win it. Ter Stegen, again, making the claim after his little beef with Neuer, so proper
stuff. That was nice.
About being the number one.
They're trending in the right direction. They just have to get Suarez out of the team and get Griezmann up front.
And Messi,
obviously, on the team. But yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. Messi came on for the last 20 minutes, was very unfit at first, got better and better as the match was going on. He's transformative because he's the best player in the world.
It's the same sort of thing. Well, it's not the same because it's Lionel Messi, but we were saying about Hazard, obviously will get better with 100%. Real Madrid, and that'll be their hope. Barcelona know that they've got, as you said, the best player in the world coming back into their team. But at the moment, Barcelona and Real Madrid, who are usually called the favourites and the people to look out for, if Lionel Messi's not playing for Barcelona and just Real Madrid in general, there's no actual reason. I think Dortmund and PSG showed it. There's no reason to be scared of either of those teams anymore.
100%, 100%.
And I don't think that's been said in quite a long while. Obviously, you have to be petrified of Messi himself. But even then, Liverpool showed that you can beat them 4-0 with Messi on the pitch as well.
That's why I emphasise that midfield, because that's going to be the difference. Because Arthur didn't play at Anfield, Frenkie obviously wasn't at the club, so that's going to make that's going to be allow Barca to at least not be useless without Messi, right?
You know, Real Madrid have no midfield, Barcelona have midfield, but Barcelona don't have a striker that will score goals until Messi comes back.
They're still both dangerous teams, aren't they? I don't think we can quite write them off to the point
not write them off, but you don't have to be scared of them. You can definitely go in, and I'm not saying
depends who you are.
We've got Barcelona away. people would have just shut down then.
Yeah.
If you apply the Norwich fearless tactic against Man City, show that they're not unbeatable.
If we live in a world where Norwich can smash Man City,
you don't have to be petrified them anymore. But the final sort of focus Champions League game we'll touch on before we look at some of the other little stats that appeared in the game was Atletico Madrid 2, Juventus 2. And Juventus became the third team to score 2 goals against Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid at home in the Champions League. So Chelsea were the last team to beat them, and it was Benfica that also scored two. So that doesn't happen a lot. But then Atletico Madrid, unlike those other two games where they lost, actually got this back to a draw. So what were your main sort of takeaways from that? Because obviously Sarri's first Champions League game with Juventus.
Well, it was all eyes on Ronaldo, obviously, after his PR tickling exercise with Piers Morgan in midweek. So yeah, I mean, he was booed every time he touched the ball, and the sometimes the camera would pan away to the Atletico Madrid fans, and the hatred in their eyes just looking at Ronaldo. Obviously, though, he absolutely loved it. I think he's got 25 goals in 34 games against Atletico, but after he failed to score last night, that's four Champions League appearances at the Wanda without a goal. So he hasn't sort of transferred as good as he was at the Calderon over to the Wanda. But it was really interesting to see how Juve set up, because it was almost like a 4-4-2 with Ronaldo and Higuain up top. But then because Ronaldo was dropping so deep to get the ball, it was almost like he moved to the left and Matuidi or Kadira moved forward to become the furthest forward player, which is really strange how that worked.
Aaron Ramsey must be licking his lips.
Well, he didn't. He brought Aaron Ramsey on too late.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Juve were really, really poor in the first half, especially going forward in the final third. Didn't string too many passes together. Atletico were well on top. Felix was looking really good counter-attacking, and if you had to choose how you thought the first goal would be scored, it would be an Atletico break. So it was quite ironic, really, that it came from a Juve break. Bonucci with a beautiful ball over the top, and then Higuain, who didn't have a sniff, looked like he was running down a blind alley, but then cut inside and pulled a...
Looked like an overcooked chicken.
Hey!
Pulled a superb ball out, and then Cuadrado finished.
Cuadrado did the rest.
Cuadrado finishes a real understatement for how good that goal was.
Superb on his weak foot as well.
He just absolutely pinged it in, didn't he?
And then the second goal was another sort of breakaway as well. Really nice ball out by Ronaldo, and then Sandro didn't have to break his stride, and Matuidi was there to nod it in. And there, at 2-0, you would back Juve, this sort of streetwise savvy team, to get it done away from home at 2-0.
No Chiellini though, isn't it?
Yeah, no Chiellini. Well, I mean, Bonucci and De Ligt looked reasonably solid, but not when Felix was running at them. When they were running back towards their own goal, they looked really shaky. And yeah, Atletico were causing lots of problems from set pieces, which both the goals came for in the end.
Senor Trippier.
Jimenez was really clever for the first one, because he was, I mean, he's a beast in the air, so he was getting a lot of joy. But Bonucci and De Ligt were sort of doing a job on him, or just because he was challenged for a header with them, he wouldn't quite manage to get on target, but he pulled away to the left, so he was jumping with Daniello, I think it was, and then knocked it back across goal, which sort of bypassed the two centre-backs, and Savic was there to nod it home. And then, yeah, the second one, beautiful ball in from Trippier, who's had his praises sung a lot, but I didn't think he was as good as people were sort of making out. Because he...
God, just let him have a good time in Spain, Sam.
Well, a few times in the first half particularly, he was picked out because although they've got... reputation for being really defensive, Atletico, their fullbacks do get really high, and they look to find him early. He received the ball, and we all know he's a one touch deliver man, but his touch let him down a couple of times, and he sort of scuffed a couple of crosses. Fair play to him for delivering when it mattered right at the end, but he wasn't as good as I thought he was, despite I think it was created the most chances of any player on match day one with 7, I think.
Wow.
So not bad.
And looked into that. Yeah, but that's what happens when you can just... Again, his crossing is... I always call him three-touch Trippier. So he takes one to control it, puts it out. And obviously, if you watch Kieran Trippier, he will never take more than three touches.
As long as he's...
And he's completely aware that that's his strength. Yeah, yeah. So that's what makes him... And Simeone has probably said, mate, get it and cross it.
As his set piece work stays like that, he will stay in that team, and he'll rack up a lot of assists, because they are incredible in the air. They've got really good organisation attacking set pieces.
And their forwards all. Joao Felix is someone as well that he's someone we were talking off air before the podcast about not being sure how tall footballers are or how big they are. And João Felix is someone that you don't expect, when you think of him, oh, because he's a 19-year-old little Portuguese wonder kid, you don't realise that he's getting up for a lot of headers himself. And then they have Costa and Morata as well.
But also, so Herrera obviously got the winner, but the other two players...
It felt like a winner.
It did.
Equaliser.
Yeah.
Carrera and Vitolo came on as well. I think Simeone deserves big credit for those changes because Sarri was a bit hesitant. I think he left it a bit too late to take off
Pjanic. Didn't have Archie to bring on, did he? But,
well, this is it. So for all the talk of their outrageous squad, really, they didn't have the options to see out that game. When it went to 2-1, it was, okay, Sarri, what are you going to do to stop this tide from turning? And he didn't have the answers. So I'd probably worry a bit for Juve in the latter stages.
Oh, well, he won the Europa League last season without losing a game. I was going to say, do you reckon his lack of... He's been in the Champions League once before. Do you think Sarri himself might be what holds Juventus back from getting that elusive Champions League?
I think so, yeah.
Because people like Simeone, who obviously has got a phenomenal record in
that. I think Sarri and the lack of Chiellini. I think, because like you said, yeah, De Ligt and Bonucci, they're kind of the same defender. They share the same weaknesses, which is pace and movement, like fast movement and that. Chiellini laps that up. Like, he's brilliant at dealing with that sort of thing. So I genuinely think, like, if he doesn't come back in this season and in great form, which, I mean, he might not do. He's an old player. That could be a big problem for them. Because I do think with Bonucci and De Ligt on the ground, you're sharing, you've got a lot of the same weaknesses at the back there, and also the striking depth, like beyond Cristiano, who is there that's going to score the goals. I mean, obviously,
Mandzukic being shipped off, Dybala not obviously being favoured, but isn't sort of really considered a goal getter.
That's another one who he brought on, Dybala, and he just offered nothing.
I think your midfield point about Matuidi being almost the pseudo forward is actually really interesting, considering that Ramsey has just made his debut. So when he's fit, and if Sarri's asking one midfielder to get that far ahead, then I think Ramsey will be, as I said, licking his lips at that possibility. But moving on from that, there was just a quick time to round up the Champions League section to mention, obviously, people that not necessarily dive into the complete tactics of the match. But, for example, we have to mention the youngest first half hat-trick scorer in Champions League history, Erling Braut Haaland. Obviously, RB Salzburg 6-2 against Genk was a pretty fun game. His post-match press conference is also quite entertaining for good and bad reasons, because he seemed to sort of be treating it like a 19-year-old would treat it, and was purposefully giving one-word answers to annoy the reporter, and then apparently got a telling off from his press officer and sort of defaulted back into the, yeah, well, it was all about the team. So if you haven't seen that, that's good to watch. But if you haven't seen him play as well,
he's
a 6'4", 19-year-old that looks like an actual mountain playing up front. And without going too much into him, and I'm sure we'll be doing, we've got articles about sort of where he's come from. Obviously, his dad famously, best friends with Roy Keane, might be the nice way of saying it.
Yeah, there's that Solskjaer quote. I don't think Man United's his favourite club, but like, we're looking at him.
Apparently he's a Leeds United fan.
Well, yeah, he was born in Leeds.
Yeah, so
expect to see his name mentioned a lot, and especially the one thing I'm looking forward to now is seeing this big hulking striker, as I said, only 19 years old somehow. Obviously in the same group as Liverpool, his battle with Virgil van Dijk is going to be really interesting, because that is going to be the clash.
And Virgil is apparently prone to errors now for the first time in forever.
Turns into a different player in the Champions League, despite lifting the trophy last season.
Yeah.
Man of the match in the final.
Yeah, exactly. Although Matip robbed, arguably, from that.
Or Alisson, 8-8. Yeah. But anyway, the point is, he's phenomenal to watch. And he reminds me in a way of he's like a bigger and stronger Kasper Dolberg when Kasper Dolberg first emerged, like 2 years ago. I mean, look, let's hope he doesn't have the same injury problems that Dolberg has, but he looks sensational, and his partnership with Huang up front is really good together. They really seem to understand each other. So, I mean,
Haaland's most striking thing, apart from the fact that he scored 17 goals in 9 games, which includes 4 hat-tricks, is that he's an athlete as well. If you watch how he starts his runs, he takes off like a sprinter in a relay, not a sprint star, but the ability to get up a serious amount of speed so quickly is something that strikes me. So someone that plays on the last line of defence is going to be...
I saw a report like, oh, Barcelona linked me. I was like, who isn't linked? We're looking at him now. Well, like, the whole world is going to be looking at this guy. Sign him first, then you'll be impressed.
Everyone's going to be linked with him. And in fact, Statman Dave got a little scoop when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer first was appointed as Man United manager. There's a YouTube video where we're talking about to a Norwegian reporter about who the Norway players coming through are, and obviously Haaland played for Solskjaer under Mulder, so that link, expect to see more of that as well.
Man United need a striker, don't they?
Exactly. He wants someone that does the little nasty tap-ins, apparently, Solskjaer. So we'll have to see how many six-yard box goals Haaland gets.
Well, he got 3 goals yesterday. Took a total of 5 touches, I think. Yeah, that's good.
So there you go. Ticks all the boxes. And also to mention that Rodri, just for Man City, despite them having no centre-backs, he still looks pretty comfortable. 82 out of 82 passes completed, 4 out of 4 dribbles completed, and 1 out of 1 aerial duels won. So Mr. Perfect for them in their 3-0 away win. Harry Kane from the spot, third fastest player to score 15 Champions League goals. Only 2 of them are penalties, before you say anything.
Mm. Ooh, on the subject of which, here's the thing. Since the start of the previous Champions League season, only Robert Lewandowski and Lionel Messi have scored more goals in the competition than Lucas Moura with 6.
Yeah.
Taking that further, because as you might have seen on Twitter, and I think Football London also did a piece, all 6 of his goals are scored away from home. So when you exclude penalties...
On the Squawker Twitter, you would have seen that.
Yeah, I don't look at that.
Yeah.
when you exclude penalties, that is at least twice as many away goals as any other player. Tadic and Mbappe both have 3. So
Lucas Moura.
Draw no conclusions from that whatsoever, because they drew.
Because they drew, yeah. Another 2 all away from home Spurs. That's 3 in a row. Yeah. 3 Desmonds in a row this season.
Did anyone predict that?
Well, it's
we missed our chance.
It's good.
They're doing the Spurs the biggest salute to the Squawker Talker you could possibly do away from home. Just all the 2-2s. Filling them out, and they've been 2-0 up in the last 2 of those. So
yeah, they've got issues, man.
But we'll move on to Spurs' issues when we do our Premier League predictions. But first, in the next section, we'll be focusing on Chelsea and Liverpool, who you might have realised that we haven't even spoken about yet. So now we move from review to preview as we take a look at Chelsea versus Liverpool in particular on the London special of football on Sunday. I think because of the Europa League, there's 4 games, I think, all playing in London, which is going to be interesting to see how that unfolds. But before we go into the actual match, I should say we're going to do one more tiny little bit of review, because Liverpool have now lost 4 away games in the Champions League group stage consecutively. They obviously go to Stamford Bridge at the weekend. You had a little bit to say about whether this away form is actually all just a bit of a myth, Will.
Well, yeah, I went into this section fully signed up to the whole idea that is a glaring weakness of Liverpool's is their away form in the Champions League. They've lost 4 group stage games on the trot, as you said, 4 out of their last 6 in total last season. I think that's including the defeat to Barcelona. But then the more I looked into it, the more I felt like, okay, maybe everyone's a little bit bad away from home in the Champions League. And you kind of have to overlook the 3-1 win over Bayern Munich, which was quite an impressive result, and then the 4-1 win against Porto. And I would say that Tuesday night against Napoli, although they weren't at their best, it did feel to me like an improvement upon the performances last season in the group stage. The 2-1 defeat to PSG, that was just a really, really strong performance, I think, from PSG. I know Neymar and Mbappe, were particularly good in that game. The 1-0 defeat to Napoli was just a rubbish game, and I think they nicked it very, very late on. And then the 2-0 defeat to Red Star was just maybe the worst performance under Klopp. But against Napoli, they seem to create quite a few chances, enough to win the game at least. Certainly that breakaway where Sadio Mane overhits the pass.
Mm.
Sadio Mane himself has a chance a little bit later on, which he just fires straight at the keeper. Alex Meret also makes a great save from Mohamed Salah. And I felt like the little partnership between Trent Alexander-Arnold, who was very good defensively, I thought. He demonstrated a little bit of craftiness in this minor incident where he won a foul from Dries Mertens, I think, in the box. an element of craftiness you don't often see in English players, let alone young ones. But his link-up play with Fabinho, I think, is becoming a very useful tool of attack for Liverpool, especially when they're playing against a high line that I think I'm probably right in saying Napoli were employing in that game, in that they'll just do a little 1-2 under pressure, and then they've both got elite long-range passing ability, so either one of them can just ping it over the top.
They can both kick it really far.
Yeah, really far and really accurately, though, yeah, is the important other element of that ability. So there were some positives there, and more generally, I don't think you can read too much into this away record in the Champions League, and I don't think it will really rock them heading into what's quite a tough game at the weekend.
A tough game, you say, on paper, but if Liverpool can't win away in the Champions League, Chelsea can't win at Stamford Bridge under Lampard yet, Sam. He has changed multiple formations, and again, there was more penalty drama as Ross Barkley was approached by Willian and Jorginho. Jorginho's one was more of a like, yeah, yeah, go on, mate, you can do it, handshake, when it really looked like, you know, I should be taking this. Yeah. And then Willian was just begging to be the penalty taker.
Well, the real star in that was Gabriel Paulista, as he went past and ruffled Barkley's hair.
The ruffle of the hair triggered the crossbar hit. But yeah, Chelsea haven't actually won at Stamford Bridge yet under Lampard, which was something that I sort of had gone under the radar. I hadn't really thought about a 1-0 defeat. In recent games, we mentioned at the top of the show, 5-2 against Wolves away from home. Tammy Abraham, 7 goals already this season. The switch into a back three is something that's going to start dominating the talk. Do you think that is what needs to be employed against this Liverpool side? And as Will mentioned there, Liverpool have two weapons to exploit a high line. And what we've seen from Chelsea so far is that Lampard definitely wants Chelsea to play a high line.
Mm. Well, I mean, their most obvious problem is defence. 11 goals are conceded in the Premier League. Only Norwich worse. And the only other two teams with double figures are Wolves and Watford, who are obviously in the bottom three. So not good company to be in. And no clean sheets in 7, if you count the Super Cup. So to be fair to Lampard, he has recognised that that's what he needs to change by tweaking the system into this 3-4-3. So at Wolves, he played Rudiger, who I think, by all accounts now, really is Chelsea's best centre-back. And Christensen and Tomori. Tomori obviously scored the pile driver. And then Valencia, he changed it up. Zouma came back in, so Zouma, Christensen and Tomori. So he's definitely still figuring out what suits his players best and the best combination. So the system definitely has its positives, but I think I would worry about Alonso and Azpilicueta. Azpilicueta was decent against Valencia, got forward well and linked up with Willian, as you would expect, considering they've played with each other for a long time now. But Alonso looked rusty, and I don't think he really want to be blowing off the cobwebs when you're playing Mohamed Salah and co.
Yeah, I think with Marcus Alonso, it's the fact that maybe the 3-4-3 was born out of the fact that Marcus Alonso has proven on many occasions that he must play as a wing-back if you're going to have any sort of success at all. Mm. I think Conte discovered that, obviously, in that first season. And then Sarri as well.
Yeah.
I know Emerson didn't play under Sarri, but a lot of people last season were highlighting quite emphatically that Marcus Alonso should be nowhere near that starting 11 when playing a back four. So perhaps that switching formation benefits him. Mm. But as you said, he hasn't played because they've been playing the back four and Emerson's been playing so well. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether Emerson is back fit for that, and if that triggers a return to a back four, or if even Emerson plays as a wing back because he's so good on the ball. I remember after the first three games, he had the most touches, the most passes and most tackles of any Chelsea player. So it was obviously thriving in Lampard's system. But at the front as well, it also puts Mason Mount, I guess, in a much freer role, but not actually playing as a winger. And we did an article, I think, as well before about the chemistry building between him and Abraham especially. And Abraham has the chance this weekend, if he scores 2, to become only the second player to score 4, to score 2+ goals in 4 consecutive games, because obviously he converted his brace to a hat-trick against Wolves, joining Luis Suarez, who did that for Liverpool. So it could be the ghost of Luis Suarez that haunts.
Well, with Mount as well, he got taken off in midweek, didn't he,
yes,
after that horrible Coquelin challenge from Coquelin. So he's going to be a fitness doubt. But I'd probably say Lampard got that substitution wrong. I think he brought on Pedro. Whereas Barkley, I would probably say a bit more creativity, because once Matt went off, they looked a bit sort of lost in midfield. So if he is going to play the back three, then he really needs Mount to be fit as well.
Yeah, Mount has probably been one of their standout. Abraham's goals have been obviously the clear standout. And obviously, Chelsea just can't stop their academy graduates, can't stop scoring. 11 goals this season, all academy graduates, all under the age of 22, and all English, which is a record pretty much for Chelsea everywhere you look, and something that's not happened. So you can expect the trend maybe to continue, because Liverpool themselves have only kept one clean sheet this season. Chelsea haven't won at Stamford Bridge, but they keep scoring in every game. Is there anything Jurgen Klopp can do, Mo, to maybe impose Liverpool upon that Chelsea team and make sure that they still don't get any wins at Stamford Bridge?
Play Oxlade-Chamberlain. That's the simple thing. Look, Liverpool are a very good side. Napoli lost notwithstanding. They've started the season fairly well. They've lost Alisson, and I mean, not shaking it off, because they've clearly looked weaker without him, but they've carried on winning top of the Premier League. You know, they're perfect so far. But you know, what you saw against Napoli was that maybe there's something. You know, sometimes you can undermine them a little bit. What makes Liverpool so good? Obviously, part of what makes them so good is the fact that Salah and Mane are both so good on the ball. They can kill you there. But then also they're both so good off the ball that when the ball goes into Firmino, you can't keep track of them. But what Liverpool do lack right now is any sort of penetration from midfield, like beyond Henderson running off the ball. They don't have someone who can carry the ball through the middle of the park and actually like scare teams in addition to the front three. And that's where Oxlade-Chamberlain comes in. Obviously, and Klopp always had a big plan for Oxlade-Chamberlain, and then he got injured, so it completely derailed it. And you know, you have to feel that Oxlade-Chamberlain being the player that he is why, part of why he was happy to let Coutinho go. Not that Oxlade-Chamberlain is the same as Coutinho, but I mean, look, since the start of 17-18, right, Henderson has completed 0.35 dribbles per 90. Now, it's not his job, but, you know, it's just to illustrate a point. Fabinho's 0.45, Milner's 0.66. Now, onto the other two that would be more likely to. Gini Wijnaldum, 1.2 dribbles per 90 completed since the start of 17-18. Naby Keita, 1.55. Oxlade-Chamberlain, 3.01. So, you can see the massive spike in ball carrying that he would bring to the Liverpool midfield, which I think would deeply, deeply unsettle Chelsea. Because they've already got enough on their plate to deal with the front three. And if they play a back three, by the way, they'll basically be man-to-man against the front three, which is ripe for a midfielder to just suddenly sort of run in through the gaps that are created while the three defenders are minding the three forwards. And
especially the criticism of the likes of Jorginho and Kovacic. And if Conte's not there, is the mobility of that midfield. So if you can have someone that can spring past those two with one step over, then you unlock everyone else.
I think I'm right in saying he completed all four of his dribbles against Southampton. So I would pause when comparing those figures because of how the system sort of changed. He has demonstrated in the same system this season that he still likes to dribble and still dribbles more than the average of the other midfielders he's competing with in terms of those positions. The other thing that I think Oxlade-Chamberlain would bring is that Milner and Henderson, when they arrive late onto like a loose ball, just latching onto it and like getting a shot off on goal, you can see there's a lot of technical ability there, but they seem to, like, not panic, but they basically always miss the target.
You were skirting around the issue there, but
that's not a, like, they don't always miss the target. That's not a statistical truth. But Oxlade-Chamberlain, and this is perhaps that memory of the memory
I was
going to
say, you're being swayed by the fact that whenever Oxlade-Chamberlain shoots, it's a rasping drive that either whistles past the post.
Essentially, yeah, this is the point that I'm tiptoeing around for no reason.
It's because I just called you out on it. Just because he kicks it nicely.
It's just goals from midfield, essentially, is what Liverpool could do with, maybe. And In my mind, there have been certain situations where the finishing of the midfielders that we have hasn't really been effective, and Oxlade-Chamberlyn could change that.
Need Wijnaldum to pull on an orange shirt, and then he'll start scoring.
Or
be 4-0 down against Barcelona, and turns into
last 10 minutes in Netherlands shirt. He seems to love it. Going on to predictions for this game, then. After that, so Chelsea's back three maybe to, I think, playing a back three against. You don't mark Roberto Firmino anyway, so it's going to be so difficult. But I guess it reduces the amount of channels the amount of space in the channels for Salah and Mane.
Yeah, because
to
they can
exploit.
Just sit back to five because, with Kovacic and Jorginho, so it will make it compact in there.
Yeah, so your middle man is actually never going to touch Firmino, but at least he's got two either side for those channel runners for Salah and Mane. So it could be the way forward. Does that mean it will yield any points, Sam?
No, I think it's going to be another defeat for Frank. 3-1 to Liverpool.
A clinical...
I actually think that they will somehow pull it out. I think there'll be a 1-1 draw. I don't think they'll win because that's
end
not
the perfect run.
But I think they'll pull off a 1-1. They might get outplayed. Well, they will get outplayed, but I think they will. I think they'll pull it out. I think maybe Tammy will bag another one. But I think 1-1.
We've seen this fixture before already this season. Remember?
Yeah. So this is Liverpool's toughest game before the trip to Old Trafford they have in late October that we worked out, I think when you were doing a post-match, the post-Arsenal piece, would be the game in which they can, if they win all their games preceding it, equal Man City's record win streak of 18 games.
Yeah.
Oof. Between the Chelsea game and then, I think it's Leicester at home and Sheffield away, which are both winnable on paper, even if Liverpool didn't, I think, win the same fixture last season. I think 2-1 Liverpool. But like I said, it is the toughest game on paper of this streak. So, and these streaks do have to end. Well, they don't have to
You're
end.
You're talking yourself into a prediction for Chelsea to win.
But I still think 2-1 Liverpool.
2-1 Liverpool. I also think Liverpool will just win this because Chelsea... As we said, they are becoming really fun to watch, but there's too many frailties, and Firmino as well. I think it's just been. I don't know if I'm just swayed by the flair,
the back heel assist for.
But he's
Salah against
he
Newcastle.
Is he's probably been one of the top three players in the Premier League already this season. I know it's very early, but the difference he makes when he's coming off or when he's coming on, he's just obscene, and I just think he's going to bamboozle that Chelsea back three, no matter who plays, and then Salah and Mane are just. Sweeping up everything that he puts their way, so I imagine I think 3-1 is probably going to be a similar result because Chelsea under Lampard, if they go a goal down, it will just be let's try and score, and Liverpool are the one team you don't really want to do that against. One, because they can defend, and two, because on the transition they are frightening.
The table is really it looks really interesting at the moment in how all those teams are bunched so closely together. You've got Man City, I think, on 10 or 11 points.
A surprise water bottle.
It will do that from time to time. It's got a mind of its own. And then you've got like a cluster of teams from 1 to 8, from 3rd to 8, who are all on 8 points.
Yeah.
And several of them are playing each other this weekend.
Which ties us in perfectly. The last thing we need to do on this podcast is rattle through our predictions in the Premier League. And of course, if you've got something specific to say on each of the fixtures, because we haven't been able to talk about everyone, obviously with the return of the Champions League has reduced the focus on Premier League games, but Premier League predictions begin, and we start with a Friday night feast of football, Southampton versus Bournemouth. Sam, what are you thinking for this one?
My man Aaron Ramsdale is still searching for his clean sheet, first clean sheet of the season. So
woo-woo.
I think this is going to be the week. 2-0 to Bournemouth.
Will.
I've gone 2-1 Southampton. Their results have picked up, or seem to, and it might be coming together.
Didn't you have a little? You mentioned a little statty, big chances statty as well.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Only Man City and Liverpool have created more of what Opta define as big chances in the Premier League this season so far.
Than Southampton,
yeah.
So.
They're quite low down the table for chances created.
But when they do create one,
bog standard chances created. But yeah.
But when they do create one, it's big. So they're going to win, Mo.
No, I bet against Eddie Howe last week. I'm not doing that again. 3-1 Bournemouth.
I think Eddie Howe is the man that you would bet against again, sort of thing. Considering Bournemouth, not him per se.
I know what you mean.
His Bournemouth team are very much well. If they didn't lose this week, they're probably going to lose this week.
No, I'm backing them firmly. Cannon Wilson hat trick.
So these are two teams who are like within touching distance of quite high places in the table. And the point I was sort of getting to before my water bottle derailed me earlier on was that I think this could be the game week that unlocks the table and makes it look a lot more like a, you know,
like splits it,
you
know, almost.
Like splits it up into tiers, and you get an idea of who's going to be facing a relegation threatened season and who's going to be, you know, maybe gunning for the Europa League spot.
Oh, gunning for the Europa League spots, what everyone dreams of. Bournemouth, Southampton, Everton, Crystal Palace are on 7. And then you have, as you said, the West Ham, Arsenal, Chelsea, Leicester and Man United and Spurs on 8. So there is that huge cluster of 1 point. So there could be, as you said, a lot of shuffling. Leicester and Spurs is the next game, the early kickoff on Saturday. Battle of the 8-pointers. Where do we see that one going, Sam?
I think that Pochettino is going to make changes. Ndombele had a stinker. Aurier, I expect to probably come back in. And it was a draw that felt like a defeat for Spurs, and I think they'll be feeling it. So I think 1-1.
Yeah, I've gone for 1-1 as well. Leicester seem to have been quite defensively strong this season for all the talk of their attacking options. And Spurs actually are yet to win any of their last 8 away games in the Premier League.
If you watch the Olympiacos game, Spurs are very vulnerable to pace. What does Jamie Vardy have? A lot of pace. Leicester are going to do him 2-1 Leicester.
2-1 Leicester.
Spurs are looking ropey, man.
As I mentioned, 3-2 alls for Spurs away from home this season. It would be silly not to predict the same again, given it's such a favourite scoreline. But that's probably the only prediction I'm going to make, because I'm just leaving it all to you three this week. Burnley versus Norwich is next.
Battle
Norwich fresh. Well, not fresh, because they might be, depending on how... I'd love to see their injury thread this week. Yeah. If they're just like, he's back. Although I think a lot of them were ligament and cruciate 9-month injuries. So don't expect a happy thread this week anyway. But I digress. We just want to know the score, Sam.
I think it's going to be 0-0.
Oh!
Norwich coming back down to earth.
Crashing back down.
They're the last team that you'd want to be playing is Burnley.
Well,
they'll be sitting there, if they've been patting themselves on the back all week, then Burnley will be there.
Polar opposites. Yeah.
This is the first of my 2-2 predictions.
The first of. That's what we like to hear.
Because as you've mentioned, we're still dealing with a probably injury hit Norwich team who have been handily beaten in their 2 away games this season. I think there was the cup loss as well. Crawley Town. And they have, statistically, the worst defence in the league. So even though Burnley in general have been poor themselves, I think they'll just cancel
Barnes.
Barnes back on the wagon.
The Barnes factor.
Do we remember 2012 when Athletic Bilbao smacked fire at Man United at Old Trafford, right? Everyone was like, they're amazing. They got to the final of the Europa League and Atletico Madrid just shut them down. That's exactly what's going to happen here. This is not Man City. They're not going to give you chances or space to play in. They're not trying to come here. They're going, let's do this. We're going to play them. And Burnley like, no, go away and just...
Turn more.
2-1. 2-1 Burnley.
Everton versus Sheffield United next on the list.
So Everton have drawn 1, lost 1. You just don't know what you're going to get with them, but I think they're going to win 2-1.
You don't know what they're going to get, but I think they're going to get.
Well, following that pattern.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I mean,
it should be a draw, but I've gone.
No.
At Goodison Park, they're essentially, potentially a top 6 side. Away from home, they're like relegation battling form. They're at home, so I'm going to say 1-0.
No, anything on this?
Everton are going to win, I think. They're a good side at home. I think it'll be 1-0. They'll just about sneak it through.
Sneaky 1-0 wins for Everton. Man City versus Watford. The bruised egos of Manchester City versus the revitalised Hornets at the Etihad.
I think everything that went wrong for City last week is going to go right, and they're going to win 4-1.
Yeah, I've gone 3-1. I don't know if they'll necessarily keep a clean sheet.
They're not that many of those this season either. Mo?
I do think they're going to unleash the whirlwind, because they've been pent up, they've been frustrated. They're going to take it out on Watford. But I do think Watford will score, I think, a 3-1 or 4-1. 4-1, let's say 4-1.
2 4-1s there. We've actually got an agreement.
Might be worth pointing out as well that I think the shock defeats to Leicester and Crystal Palace last season came quite close together, so it does seem like when things go badly for City, it tends to bunch up in their fixture list.
But they've already bounced back though against Shakhtar.
You've all just said they'll win though.
Yeah, I know, but
change it. 4-1 to Watford. Flying pens and exploding lids on this week's episode of the Score Couture podcast. And also Newcastle versus Brighton score predictions.
So 18th versus 16th.
Ooh.
Thriller written all over it.
Yep. Saturday night thriller.
No, 1-1 I've gone for.
1-1.
2-2.
It is. Ding.
0-0.
0-0. Oh. What did you predict for Southampton Bournemouth?
3-1 Bournemouth.
Oh, I was thinking Mo's TV picks are all going to be the dullest. It won't be a good week. It won't be a good weekend for the broadcasters.
Mate, Callum Wilson hat trick. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, of course, there you go. So we move on to the four games in London on a Sunday, which is born out of the fact that the Europa League, all the Europa League teams play, don't they? Wolves, Man United, Arsenal.
Houston changeover is going to be.
That's my stake.
Jake just turned white as a sheet. Yeah.
I didn't even think about it.
Blood drained from his face.
I might have to sleep over. Palace versus Wolves is what I've got down first at 2 p.m.
Yes, well, obviously we're talking before Wolves have played in the Europa League. They're making all the right noises about fatigue not being a factor, but I just think it's going to be, and they're going to take their eye off the ball until they sort of get adjusted to the Thursday-Sunday schedule. So I think 2-1 to Wolves. 2-1 to Palace.
They're
going to
take their eye off the schedule and win 2-1.
Well, the old twist ending there.
Yeah, no one saw that one.
The M. Night Shyamalan prediction.
Wolves are doing what Burnley did last season.
Yeah, I literally got here written down they're doing a Burnley. Yeah, I don't think they're going to have the energy to break down Palace, who've been really, really defensively solid this season. So I think 1-0. 1-0 Palace.
I think 0-0 because Palace aren't going to score a goal.
Yeah, Palace only score away. West Ham versus Man United is the other 2 p.m. in London.
Well, West Ham pull at least one good result out against the top six in the season usually, so I think this is going to be it. So 2-1 with Felipe Anderson. The man doing the damage.
I think this is a super interesting game. It's among those teams who are both on 8 points.
Yeah.
West Ham could had they beaten Aston Villa, which they would have had a better chance of doing had they not gone down to 10 men relatively early in the game. They could be level on points with Man City.
I think it would have been their best ever start to a Premier League season.
Yes. So that's well done, West Ham. Really. And I also think Man United. Have been a little bit better than the results suggest. So it's quite not an evenly matched team, because I think Manchester United obviously have the better squad. Teams are interesting. Teams sort of like quite evenly matched in terms of form. And when you consider that West Ham are the home side, it might be quite a difficult game for United. I do think they'll have just about enough to edge it 2-1.
West Ham,
as long as they demonstrate some ability to manage games, which has been, like Chelsea, quite lacking in terms of...
West Ham caused Man United a bit of trouble at Old Trafford last season, remember? There was those two penalties that did it. But yeah, West Ham, obviously, they've got 8 points. They've also scored 8 goals, and they've conceded 8. So
5 of which came against Man City. Yes.
I can imagine it all going to 9 next week, Mo.
Yeah, I think United will win 1-0, because I think West Ham will come and play. They won't just sit back and absorb it, and so they'll come and play. So that will help United play their natural game. And so I think they'll win 1-0, just about sneak it.
And then the final two games of the weekend: Arsenal versus Aston Villa at home. Luckily for some Arsenal fans, perhaps. Do you think the absolute aberration that was the performance against Watford will repeat itself at the Emirates?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if Socrates starts.
He's been rested for the again. We've not we, we're doing this before Europa League. Him and Ozil rested for the Europa League trip. Rob Holding back on the plane. But you'd imagine someone coming back from that injury. If he does play on Thursday, he definitely won't play Sunday.
I think Arsenal win 2-0.
Clean sheet for Arsenal.
I think they'll get a clean sheet as well. I think this will be like the Arsenal of the beginning of the season we saw, where they sort of win it late on through a Bamiyang goal.
That's the recipe.
1-0 Arsenal.
I said I don't know if you were on, who was on when I was going on my Crystal Palace Arsenal.
Oh, I missed that week.
Zaha, yeah.
So I didn't realise Arsenal were not only doing a Crystal Palace impression in terms of some sort of tactics, but also just mid-table mediocrity. The performance against Watford, as you probably all know, just to 31 shots is like the most that I've received. And if you look at shots on target for versus against, Crystal Palace actually have a better ratio. So Arsenal face more shots on target per game on average than they have shots on target. Which is as 11th, and for an example, the best two is Man City have 2.87, and Liverpool have 2.2, and then there's a few clusters in one. Man United have 1.3, for example. Palace is 0.94, Arsenal's 0.92. So they are actually doing a bad Crystal Palace impression.
But Palace, it's intentional, because that's their conservative style of play.
Exactly, they need
Arsenal,
to do it.
Not so much.
Look, this is going to be a shooting gallery, but I think Arsenal have the better gunslingers, basically. They'll win 4-2.
But the point is, Arsenal don't... If there is the opportunity to have a shooting gallery, they still don't do it.
No, I'm backing them. Right. I'm backing Aubameyang.
Aubameyang is Arsenal would be much lower. They probably wouldn't have even got Europa League if they didn't have one of the best strikers in the league.
Yeah, I'm backing him and Lacazette.
Lacazette's injured.
Oh, is he? Oh, well, oh God. No, you know what? I'll still
Arsenal's
go.
Best player.
Yes, according to Danny Ceballos.
Jinx.
Final game, Chelsea-Liverpool, we've already
done. We
can't
continue with the pod, because Jackie's not allowed to talk.
My mouth has been locked by Will. Well, I was lucky, actually, because even though I am still talking, we technically wouldn't have had to do Chelsea-Liverpool, because we already knew those predictions, but just to rattle through.
3-1 Liverpool.
Oh, this is the ultimate test to see how confident you are in your predictions,
in case
you can't remember it. 2-1 Liverpool.
Says the man stalling.
1-1.
Oh, he didn't check Mo T's.
I was
going to
change
it.
I thought, no, you know, well, let me be resolute. Stick by my
He's
1-1.
Resolute. And with such resoluteness, this podcast is brought to an end. So thank you all for joining me on the Champions League and Premier League preview stuff. Thank you to everyone that was listening. And thank you to BetBull for sponsoring the episode. As always, follow us on there. We'll be doing predictions. Hopefully we do better than next week if you're 18 plus and you're gambling, where the link will be in the podcast description. But that is all for this week. We'll see you next time.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.